Today's Science Friday podcast sponsor is O'Reilly Media with Learning Paths Video Training, your most direct route to learning a new skill or technology, from big data to programming languages to UX design. Find your path today, O'Reilly.com/go/SciFry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to wrap up our Sci-Fry book club, The Soul of a New Machine. That's what we're reading. We hope you are, too. The first news headlines. Even city dwellers can spot wildlife if they know where to look, and we're not talking just pigeons here. Parks and green spaces, of course, can affect where animals hide out in the concrete jungle. But how does socioeconomic income of an area affect their habitat? Journalist Brandon Keim is here for that story and other selected short subjects in science this week. Welcome back, Brandon.
Hey, Ira. Great to be back.
Let's talk about scientists measuring diversity of wild animals in Chicago.
So this was a study. It was led by a biologist named Seth Magel and his team at the University, sorry, not the University of Chicago, at Chicago's Urban Wildlife Institute. And so what they wanted to know is where do animals in the city live, and especially possums and raccoons and coyotes. And so they tracked them across the city. And so what you'd expect to find is that where there's more green space, there's more animals. It stands to reason. But it turns out it wasn't actually that simple. It also seemed to matter what the socioeconomic status of the surrounding area was. So in other words, green space in a wealthier neighborhood is better for animals than green space in a poorer neighborhood. And they don't know why exactly this is. They think it's, you know, chances are people in these different communities are managing their landscapes differently, managing their lawns differently. But, you know, it's a really interesting phenomenon. It fits with other research that already exists, which is looking at the relationship between socioeconomics and bird distribution and plant diversity. And what, you know, scientists are seeing is that they're actually, you know, there actually seems to be an environmental justice issue here with urban animal diversity, with nature. You know, the richer you are, the richer nature you get.
Next up, we hear a lot about neonicotinoids affecting bees, but the neonics are also a problem in the water?
They very well seem that they are. You know, this is an issue that's flown under the radar a bit compared to the pollinator stuff. But more and more scientists have been concerned about what they've been doing in the environment. And there was a study that just came out last week by researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey. And they did a nationwide survey of streams and rivers, and they found neonics in half of the waterways that they sampled. And just to be clear here, this is not a human health issue. Mm-hmm. This is really about ecology. But, you know, they themselves didn't look at the ecological consequences. But other researchers have found that there does seem to be pretty significant insect declines at the levels that they measured. And, you know, so the, you know, okay, who cares about a bunch of bugs and streams, right? But these are really foundations of the food web. You know, so many other birds and fish and amphibians and reptiles depend on them. I think this is an issue we're going to be hearing a lot more about.
You know, it makes sense that if you're spraying this around, it's going to get into the water, right? Sooner or later.
It does make sense. And, you know, there was the hope originally that these chemicals would just break down, but it turns out a lot of them do just end up going into the water.
Unintended consequences. Again, there is a new study that chimes in on the fish oil debate. Is it good? You know, we've been talking about this for years. Is fish oil good for you? Does it lower your cholesterol? All kinds of stuff like that.
4 years. And, you know, there is that big bulk of research that suggests that eating foods high in omega-3 fatty acids, mm-hmm. to be specific, you know, so fish, of course, walnuts, flax seeds, all that seems to be good for us and also good for protecting our minds against the degeneration that comes with age. But the question is whether you get the same effect from the supplements, from the pills. And that's not quite settled yet, but there was just a study that came out this week. Researchers from the National Eye Institute tracked 4,000 people over 5 years. That's a lot of people. Some of them had the supplement, some of them didn't, and it turned out that there didn't seem to be any effect of the supplements on slowing cognitive decline. And I wouldn't, you know, this won't be the very last word in the science.
So they looked at older people?
It was older people. There were people who were taking the supplements because of age-related macular degeneration. Right. So, you know, there could be different effects in people who take them earlier in their lives or other groups of people. But all that said, this does suggest that, you know, if you want to get the health benefits of eating fish, you've got to actually eat the fish.
Curses. Of course, it's fish is good. It tastes great. Well, finally, we know that Alan Turing, we know all about him because he was a math genius. And researchers found one of his patterns on an eye of an insect. Tell us about the pattern and what that was all about.
Yeah. So of course, the Alan Turing story, it's an extraordinary one. Anybody who doesn't know it, just Google him. Shortly before the tragic end of his life, he spent a little time thinking about nature. And of course, everybody else, we all know him from, you know, computational science and breaking the Nazi codes and what have you.
And movies now.
And movies now. And just an amazing man. So, but he postulated shortly before the end of his life a really simple chemical mechanism for producing very complicated patterns. And it was just theory at the time. It was just him speculating. But in the coming decades, researchers found what are now known as Turing patterns all throughout the natural world, in spots on seashells and leopard spots, the organization of cells and developing organs, apparently in constellations of galaxies. Just amazing. But also in the eyes of insects. And this team of Russian biologists, they were looking at the eyes of insects across the animal insect kingdom with very high-powered atomic microscopes, and they found that these structures on the insect's eyes actually seemed to be arranged in Turing patterns. And that seems to be connected also to, you know, the really incredible property of the insect's eyes. They're water-repellent and self-cleaning, anti-reflective, just marvelous.
Hmm. Very interesting. What does it mean? Is it going to impact technology, or it'll make us all rich, or it's just nice science discovery?
Well, you know, it's certainly the sort of insight that could give rise to better smartphone screens or camera lenses. And as somebody with a smartphone and a camera, I don't want to downplay that. But to me, the great significance of it is just in the beauty of the fact that, you know, these patterns that were conceived of by Alan Turing, that too brief moment when he turned his incredible mind to nature, that you can find these in everything from, you know, from galaxies to scales on the eyes of an insect.
Richard Feynman would love that. Mm. He loved nature and science and things like that.
It is a romantic fact.
He recognized the beauty in nature and science. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Brandon Keim is a freelance science reporter, he's does other kinds of stuff besides being on science writing. It's time now to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. When you prepare to dig into a pint of ice cream, do you make sure to only scoop out a single serving size? I don't know anybody who does that, but, you know, those serving sizes, they're just tough to figure out how big a serving is. Well, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has taken notice. About 20 years after introducing the Nutrition Facts label, the FDA is moving to update what's listed as a single serving on those labels to better reflect how much Americans actually eat in their diet. But will updated labels help us become more informed consumers, or are we just going to eat a lot more ice cream? Joining me to discuss the good and bad of overhauling the FDA serving sizes is Roberto Ferdman. He's a reporter for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the good thing about revamping?
Well, the good thing about this is that these nutrition fact labels and the serving sizes on them really are going to be more honest. So you mentioned ice cream, and that's a pretty apt example. Ice cream for the longest time has had a serving size as half a cup. Now, I've never eaten half a cup of ice cream. I try to not eat ice cream because I never eat half a cup,
right.
Which means that the numbers on the back of ice cream pints, which tell you how much fat and sugar and other nutrients are inside of that ice cream, aren't really representative of what a serving means to you when you eat it, or to me at least.
You know, I'm holding here a bag of snacks, and you're trying to find the serving size and whatever on it.
Right. There are other examples, too. So with chips, sometimes it's for the entire bag. Sometimes it's for a certain number of chips. They'll tell you in the back that it's for 8 chips or 10 chips. I don't know. But the thing is that they're not very honest because the serving sizes are based on surveys that were taken essentially in the 80s. These were first implemented in the early 90s. So they're working to update them. They found that almost 20% of them are not representative of what Americans customarily eat, which is the definition of serving sizes.
So what's the bad news about any of this?
So in retrospect, I feel like I wrote about this just in order to come on this show because the bad side is pretty bad. The problem with that is that people don't understand what serving sizes mean. Americans don't understand what serving sizes mean. They think that they're recommended portions. So if for a cup of ice cream, which is going to then become a cup of ice cream, which is going to be the serving size, people understand that means that's how much they should eat. They'll eat more than they were before because what they're doing is eating an amount relative to the serving sizes. So a study recently by New York University or undertaken at New York University tested this exact theory. And what they found is that when people were exposed to, for example, a box of mini cookies that said that the serving size was 3 cookies and then another that said that the serving size was 6 cookies, those who saw the 6 cookies asked for more cookies.
So if you make the, so if we increase the serving size to reflect how much people really eat, people are going to be eating more.
That's exactly what's going to happen. We're going to have serving sizes that are more honest, and we're going to have stomachs that are maybe, you know, a bit larger.
Any, what's your take on this? Is there a better way to do any of this stuff?
The kind of consensus opinion from people who are not happy with this decision or pending decision is that, since we don't understand what serving sizes mean, the best way to go about it is to both implement serving sizes that are more accurate and honest, as the FDA is attempting to. I mean, this is a well-intentioned fix to a problem. But to change the name, serving sizes, because serving is kind of emblematic of a unit of measurement. It's suggestive. I think we can agree that a serving is you know, the equal to, like, a portion.
Right.
Portion is not the word that we should use to replace it. But maybe to get rid of serving altogether, to just make clear that it is a fraction of the box, and it's a way in which to communicate nutritional information to us.
Because no one looks at it anyhow. I mean, no, few people, I guess, do, but, you know.
Depends on how I'm feeling about myself.
All right. Yeah, I think that's true of everybody. Thank you, Roberto.
Thank you for having me.
Roberto Ferdman is a reporter for Washington Post's Wonk blog. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Tracy Kidder's 1981 tech classic, The Soul of a New Machine. It's our Sci-Fi book club. Get ready. Dust off that copy. Undog those dog ears. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 3 weeks ago, the Sci-Fi Book Club dusted off Tracy Kidder's 1981 True Tech Tale, The Soul of a New Machine. We time-traveled back to the dawn of the mini-computer revolution. Coders wore pocket protectors. Computers were the size of washing machines. And the white-hot center of tech was not Silicon Valley. It was Massachusetts Route 128. Oh, yes, I do remember those days. Well, this week, the book club is back to talk about The Soul of a New Machine. And sure, computers are smaller today, but are computer engineers any different? We're calling on all you book clubbers out there to join in. Tell us what you thought about The Soul of a New Machine, especially if you are a computer engineer. That could be interesting to compare your notes. Our number, 844-724-8255. I'll say that again, 844-724-8255, or SciTalk. You can tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce our in-studio readers today. Stephen Levy is the editor-in-chief of the online tech publication Back Channel. He's the author of a lot of books about tech, including the tech classic Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution, and Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the computer that changed everything. Welcome back to Science Friday, Steve.
Great to be back. Thanks.
Jocelyn Goldfein is an angel investor, a startup veteran, former engineering executive at Facebook and VMware. She joins us from Palo Alto. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thank you. As always, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, joins me in the studio. Welcome back, Annie.
Thanks, Ira.
Let's give out the number one more time, 844-724-8255, if you want to talk with us. All right, Annie, for everybody playing catch-up, remind us what this book is all about.
Okay. Well, we are doing some time traveling, so think your way back to the late 1970s. And we are embedded with a group of about 30 computer engineers who are in a race against time to deliver what their company, Data General, desperately needs, which is the next big thing in mini computers, and that's a 32-bit machine, because they are getting creamed in the market right now because they do not have this 32-bit machine, and now it's up to this very enigmatic manager named Tom West and his band of 30 engineers to kind of do and succeed in this great act of recovery, as Tracy describes it. So that's kind of the Cliff Notes version. But actually, my favorite pitch, the best pitch I've ever heard on behalf of this book, comes from one of its longtime fans, and that is Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak.
The Woz.
The Woz is a fan. So when we found that out, of course, we had to ask whether he would help us introduce the book. And he said he would. This is what he said.
Books about new technology come at it from a business perspective. Soul of a New Machine is not this sort of book. It is an inside story by an author who lived with the design team members. This book explains in normal language how the personalities and skills of the engineers and direct managers were reflected in their design styles, problem hunting, and in the final machine. Soul of a New Machine makes you appreciate that the souls of the inventors are in the machine and that the human is more important than the technology.
So as he points out, you know, this is something kind of special that we don't see a lot, which is a portrait of engineers at work.
Steve, Olivia, you agree? This is it's about people, and computer design is about the people.
Yeah, I do agree. Rereading the book, and this is the third time I've read the book. I read it not long after it came out. I dipped into it again maybe about 6 years when I was trying to compile a list of great technology books. Of course, it made it. And I looked at it this week. And again, it struck me about what a great human tale it is, a tale of creation within a big organization. It gets not only into the personalities of the people who design the computer, but a little bit about the managers and about how they handle the various tides that go in a corporation and competition within a corporation there. And particularly, it captures that moment in time in the late 1970s when it was a quite a different world. And maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the differences.
Well, let's talk about that. I remember Route 128. I know you covered that whole. What did they have a name for it back in those days, Ed? The 128 corridor, right?
Yeah, there was the famous tech corridor. It's funny, when you would go, I did visit it sometimes in the early 80s. I went to DEC. They had a little museum there with even earlier computers in the DEC museum. But you would drive up that highway, but you would never see anything. All the stuff was in these little driveways and kind of in the woods just off the highway there. So maybe you could hear the highway when you got to the parking lot, but it wasn't really a great tourist attraction.
Jocelyn Goldfein, give us your impression, because I know you were new to the book, right?
Yes. It's interesting, actually, because my dad was at DEC in those years, and my family, actually, before I turned 7, had moved between Boston, San Jose, and Boston a couple times as he bounced between DEC and Intel. But reading the book about his era was fascinating to me, actually, because it is so like and yet so unlike the way we make software and technology today. I came up with this ratio. I think it's about, one-third different and two-thirds the same.
Let me ask all of you a question for everybody. What struck you about the book as dated, and what still rings true? Jocelyn, let me begin with you.
Some things are really dated. Slide rules, writing code down on a piece of paper. No one would code on a piece of paper. That's unthinkable. Or attaching an oscilloscope and, to measure voltage in the physical circuits. That's really dated. But the human side of it that Woz talked about, that's just the same. You know, the hunger you get when you've worked on a bunch of projects that have been canceled and how that makes you really want to ship. This concept of signing up and the way it creates this web of mutual responsibility and kind of being there for each other in the foxhole, the kind of delirium of the all-night debugging session and sort of contorting your brain to think the way a machine does, all of that is exactly the same.
Steve?
Well, I agree with Jocelyn there, but I think there is a huge difference, really, just in the way and the programmers see themselves and what they're doing there. The mission of this group was basically to catch up to their competitor.
Yeah.
You know, DEC had this computer called the VAX that was the apex of mini computers at the time. They had to catch up. And they did a pretty good job. Actually, the computer they made kept their company, which was ultimately doomed, afloat for a while. But it was all creation within this idea of helping the corporation generation win. They weren't changing the world by it. And I'm struck rereading it by the lack of prediction, let's say, of what these computers would mean to us.
Yeah.
Even at the time the Kidder was writing, there was word processing. The Apple computer was out. In the Boston area in particular was the home of spreadsheets. But the word spreadsheet isn't in there.
He doesn't... VisiCalc, was it?
No, VisiCalc. And it's interesting because, ironically, Ray Ozzie, who was the inventor of Symphony, the big program there, and later Lotus Notes.
Lotus Notes.
He worked at Data General, probably right before Tracy Kidder got there, right? So he was sort of in the bubble of thinking people will never need a computer on their desk.
Wow. Well, and it's interesting to hear from the engineers, because when they say, you know, a computer is only the hot box, as they call it, for 2 years, and then it's over. It has the lifespan of a washing machine, is I think what Tom West says. And so they know this going in. Like, this is not the change the world, you know, insanely great machine. And yet they still pour their whole soul into it. And so the question kind of seems to be, you know, for Tracy, why? And I think the answer that you come away with is engineers like to build things.
Geeks like to be geeks.
That's what they do.
Yeah. I want to go to the phones now because we have Tom West's daughter on the line. Is it in Randolph, Vermont? Is it Jessamine?
Jessamine West, yeah.
Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Hi.
Hi there. You read the book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I read it when it came out in 1981, and I go back to it every now and again and sort of refresh it. I'm on it for, I think, 10 words on one page. I'm the daughter he goes bike riding with.
Oh, wow. I mean, do you see your dad in the book? Like, did it strike you as a true depiction?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was great. We would look at it and be like, he does exactly that thing with his hands. He does exactly that thing when he talks. Of course, the thing about the book was, that was all taking place for the most part when he wasn't home. So
right.
It actually gave me a better view of what the heck he was doing all the time, as opposed to, I mean, Tracy was living with us over the weekends, but during the week we never saw him. And so that actually fleshed him out as a human for me when I was a little kid.
Wow. Were you surprised about the work environment? Did you understand where your dad was going to work every day?
Yeah. I mean, at first, of course, when you're little and somebody tells you they're an engineer, you think they drive a train. But we would go to work with him occasionally. You know, he'd plunk us down in front of a computer and we could, like, poke around and play Adventure or whatever the heck on those computers. But I didn't know the difference between programming and project management, for example. And so learning about that, like, these are the programmers, these are the people who are building the hardware, these are the people who are doing this, that, and the other, and I'm the guy who kind of, you know, keeps them all going. I got that, but I didn't totally get it until I sort of got older and became a professional myself.
Your dad seemed like kind of a complicated man. Did you ever get a sense of how he felt about this book? I got the impression in some cases he did obviously invited the attention from Kidder, but he wasn't, you know, a thump your chest kind of guy there. What was his view of Soul of a New Machine?
Well, it's interesting that you mention it, because he passed a couple of years ago, and Tracy was at his memorial, and it said, you know, it was unequivocal that the book had been good for him, Tracy, and he was never sure how it was for my dad. I mean, my dad, as you probably know, I mean, he was a company man. He stayed at Data General until he retired. My grandfather and great-grandfather were at AT&T until they retired. So I feel like it was interesting for him to be notorious in that way. But I also felt it sort of got in his way. If you're a project manager and you don't want to sort of get bumped up the food chain, you know, Data General is always trying to capitalize on the success of the book, the popularity of him as a personality. But one of the things that comes across in the book and was very true in real life is he was exceptionally shy. Like, he could sort of shine and really hit it at work when he needed to get things going, but he didn't want to be the center of attention as much as he wanted the things he did to have a legacy. And so, you know, reporters would call him all through his life, and he was always very short with people on the phone, because for him it wasn't about him. It was about the project. It was about the company. It was about something they all did, and he often downplayed his own role in it, even as I think you couldn't have done it without a guy like that, even if it hadn't have been him. And I don't think there's as many guys like that, or women like that, or people like that as people think. Everybody thinks they're that person, but I don't think that many people are.
Well, Jessamine, thank you for taking time to call us. It was great to reminiscing with you.
Yeah, thanks very much for talking to me.
You're welcome. Jocelyn, how much of what she was talking about fits into the engineers you know today?
Well, I think that, you know, engineers come in all shapes and sizes. I think actually maybe one of the things that's changed is, you know, in the 80s, the engineers that we see in the book, they all kind of identify as outsiders. Computers are this yeah. brand new thing. It's this brand new field. And I would say even in the 90s, when I went to college and majored in computer science, we felt like outsiders. We were the geeks. We were the nerds who, you know, watched, you know, who put Star Trek on the dorm television. And I think that the image of technology and computing has changed so much. When I look at the new college grads that Facebook is hiring today, you know, I don't think they necessarily identify as outsiders the same way that, we maybe did in the past.
Hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're doing our book club, talking about The Soul of a New Machine with Annie Minoff, Jocelyn Goldfein, and Stephen Levy. Steve, I remember reading your book, the Insanely Great, about the life and times of the Macintosh, another machine, a machine that really did change the way, not like this machine did. What was the difference between Steve Jobs and how you saw what was going on in the Soul book?
Well, I guess the difference, as I mentioned before, he really motivated his team, saying, we're going to make a dent in the universe there. They weren't just taking on IBM, though that was like a big part of it, saying, but they were saying, well, if we don't take over IBM, it's going to be 1984, you know, in the Orwellian sense, right, as opposed to the Steve Jobs sense. And he convinced his team that they were building something that was totally different. And to be honest, it really was. I read this now thinking, of what Larry Page, the head of Google, said. He said, really, it's not worth taking on a project to be 10% better than your competitor. You really have to take on something that's like much, much better, 100 times, because Moore's Law makes it possible to do something like that. And in retrospect now, I think, I don't get this from my previous readings, that Data General was totally, you know, ignorant of that equation there. They shouldn't have been building the next mini computer. They should have been building the next microcomputer or the Macintosh. Mm.
Let me get to the phones now. I asked for the engineers to call in, and they are calling in. Let me go to Ned in Portland. Hi, Ned. We have a couple of minutes before the break. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks. Go ahead.
I was an engineering manager at Tektronix, which is one of the computer measurement companies that would produce oscilloscopes, and they had a division that made workstations, and we used some computer hardware from the Route 128 from a company called Prime Computer, which was a competitor with Data General at the time. And I remember this book, I still have it, coming out, The Soul of the New Machine, and it influenced me to leave Tektronix in 1982 and join Intel Corporation, because Intel is coming out with a 32-bit machine versus the 16-bit machines that were referenced that Data General was trying to move away from. And I ended up at Tektronix calling as a sales factory sales representative to both Data General and Digital Equipment and Prime Computer to sell them on Intel architecture and that microprocessors were the way forward. And unfortunately, they were stuck in their own engineering mire and could not actually make that leap from the mini computer to the microcomputer. But the book by Tracy Kidder, Soul of a New Machine, was definitely an influence for me to change my career, which was a great, great career for me.
Do you think other engineers did that too, change their careers?
Yes. There were people at Tektronix I know, because we would talk about this book, The Soul of the New Machine, and we talked about the mode bit, for those that have read the book, about having a mode for 16 or 32 bits, and, you know, Tracy basically said, no, you can't do that. They wanted a more, you know, rather than having a 32 or 64-bit mode, or 16 or 32, wanted to have more of a seamless architecture. And we had all those discussions, and people were disillusioned where Tektronix was going to go. They were kind of in the same boat as Data General and digital, trying to stick to the knitting that they knew and not embrace the microprocessor, which, as we know today, is how the industry has really shifted.
Well, thank you for calling. It's a great little reminiscence about the old days in 128. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the soul of a new machine. Stay with us. Our number, if you want to comment, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry if you've read the book, or you can relate to it as someone who was around at that time working in the industry. We'll talk about it when we get back. Don't go away. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're just joining us, we're talking about The Soul of a New Machine, Tracy Kidder's classic book. It's our Sci-Fi Book Club selection. We're wrapping it up. With me are Stephen Levy, Jocelyn Goldfein, and Annie Minoff, our regular Sci-Fi, Sci-Arts producer. Annie?
You know, we were talking earlier about how well this book might reflect engineers today. And I don't know if this struck you, but to me, the big revelation of this book was what aesthetes these engineers were, that they were really concerned about imposing some sense of beauty or, you know, on these machines. And Jocelyn, I wondered if you connected with that at all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my career's in software more than hardware, but we take incredible pains to write beautiful code. And there's different sort of standards of beauty. There's sort of how readable is your prose, but also, I mean, if you think, I would compare it to writing a novel. There's sort of the prose itself, but there's also sort of plot lines and character development and sort of climax and anticlimax. And you have analogies for all those things in the way you structure your code, in the way different pieces interact, and what it's ugly to have side effects. And so absolutely, I think of software engineers as really as craftsmen, you know, the basement in Tom West's workshop, you know, that resonates with me. We're particular.
Yeah, no, that workshop scene is amazing. So Tracy Kidder actually brings us into the home of this engineer, Tom West, and he describes in great detail this guy's basement workshop. Mm. And, you know, he's got all of his screws and his nuts and bolts in the right containers, and you just get a sense of, you know, this is the place where he can really unleash that artistic side and, you know, create the perfect thing. Because, of course, at work you have to make compromises, right? You have to ship the machine.
Yeah.
But in the workshop you don't have to do that.
Tracy Kidder, when we talked to him earlier in the week at the Google Hangout, he made sure that we understood that it was the beauty that they were really concerned with, the quality and the beauty of the product. That they were putting out. Let me go to the phones because I have. Let's go to Steve in Oakland, California. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'd like to talk about how this striving for elegance and beauty was so influential on me when I first read this book when I was 12 years old in 1982.
Wow.
This book was given away at a university bookstore. It's actually a bookstore where I taught myself to program before I owned a computer of my own. But reading these personal accounts of not just the engineers but their youth, what they had done, the phones they had messed around with, the ideas of finding beauty in math that they found, it was incredibly influential on my life. And I'd love to see more stories like this sharing a greater diversity of all types of people in creative endeavors, because it makes a big difference when people see themselves in these sort of lights.
You know, we hear artists talking about the beauty of what they're doing, but you don't always hear that the engineers consider more or less what they're doing an art form themselves in the details that they're putting in it. Would you agree, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you find elegance in a simple solution, at times, you know, that was the beautiful code was necessitated by the technical limitations of the computer. You had to write very compact, very efficient code because things were expensive, memory was expensive. But this sort of knowing when you've hit across an elegant design, it's the same sort of feeling an artist gets when they know that it's time for them to abandon their art rather than continue to crank away at it. They see a point where it's finished, it's elegant, it's done, it's beautiful.
All right. Thanks for your call. Interesting phone call. Steve Levy?
Yeah. Right around the time this book came out was when I was just starting to write about computers, and I was focusing on computer hackers. And this was one of the very few things written about programmers which broke out of that mold of these loners in basements who couldn't talk to other people there. And I just treasured those few pages that really dug into the micro kids here. I remember reading it back there, and it was a good pointer for me as I embarked on my journey to figure out what hackers are all about.
You know, when we talked to Tracy Kidder earlier, we asked him about whether anybody in the book, or people he was, Tom or anybody, could envision the internet. And he didn't. You know, very few people were able to envision the internet.
Right. Well, I think, that is very true. But, the tragedy of the mini computer industry was they couldn't even envision the personal computer while people were buying personal computers. their big competitor, DEC, very famously, their CEO, Ken Olson, very famously said, there's really no reason for a person to have a computer on his or her desk. And I think the ultimate statement is that the internet domain for Data General, DG, eventually got bought by Dollar General.
There's something that the caller actually brought up, Steve brought up, that I wanted to follow up on, because he said it was great to see a portrayal of engineers as kind of creative people, and that it's great to have those stories out there that show, just the diversity within engineering. And of course, one of the ways in which this book was not diverse is there are very, very few women engineers in it. And so I wanted to ask Jocelyn, just, on the basis kind of the numbers game, we have, I mentioned this team of 30 computer engineers. We have one female engineer on that team. And how much has that changed just on the basis of that kind of alarming ratio in tech today?
Oh, it would be wildly different today. It would probably be two.
Double the number.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, maybe three.
Well, why is that? Do you have your own theory about why that is?
I think that it's actually funny that Stephen brought up, actually, I think one of the crucial points of it, which is we imagine computer engineering to be this lonely, dry, mathematical, you're sitting in a basement, you're on your own. And what's great about this book is that it shows that for the lie that it is. It's actually this incredible collaborative team-based effort, and the ways that you interact with each other are as or more important as the ways you interact with the technology. But I think that's not how we understand it in society, and so that gives rise to, I think, making women and girls, really girls, see it as, not accessible to them or something they're not going to be good at or something they wouldn't like to do or that would make them unpopular. And so I think we see this waning of interest in girls from very young ages, we reach college. And if you look at the computer science major today, it's actually less gender diverse. In the mid-'80s, 86, CS was probably more than a third female. Hmm. And today it's about 18%. We're going the wrong direction.
Hmm. So do we need to make it look more, to show the beauty of what they and computer engineers really see in it?
Yeah, I absolutely think that if we understood programming and designing of hardware to be the creative and collaborative act that it is, it would be infinitely more widely appealing. Another kind of diversity, it's not mentioned in the book, but we can probably assume that all 30 of those engineers were white. And I think that, the more we kind of bust open these stereotypes about what the work is like, the more people of all walks of life, I think, will come to discover how fulfilling it is to do this kind of work.
Well, I can't find a better way to wrap it up than with that statement. Thank you, Jocelyn. I want to thank all of you. Jocelyn Goldfein, an angel investor, former engineering executive at Facebook and VMware, and she was joining us from Palo Alto. Steve Levy, editor-in-chief of the online tech publication Back Channel, author of Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution. Good to see you again, Steve. Mm-hmm. And Iminoff, Science Friday's SciArts producer. Thank you, Annie, for putting this all together for us.
Sure thing.
And if you missed our book club meeting, as I say, we were meeting at Google here in New York City earlier in the week. Never fear, you can listen to a podcast of our conversation with our author, Tracy Kidder, at our website. That's at sciencefriday.com/soul. The UN has declared 2015 the International Year of Light. We've been celebrating throughout the year by exploring the captivating characteristics of light. And today we're going to talk about little devices that put out light, LEDs. Lighting has come a long way since Tom Edison lit up his first incandescent bulb in the 1880s. LED bulbs, they're popping up everywhere on planes, car headlights, in your phone. When you buy a new light bulb now, chances are it's going to be an LED one. And at the heart of every LED is not a little wire. If you open up an LED, there's a semiconductor in there. And where you find a semiconductor, you can be sure you're going to find an engineer trying to tinker with it. And my next guest is researching how to wirelessly stream data through everyday LED bulbs. Can your lamp become your Wi-Fi station? He's here to tell us the state of Li-Fi. That's a term that he coined. In the future, we'll be logging on to networks. Could that be as simple as flipping a switch on your light bulb? Harold Goss is a professor of engineering at University of Edinburgh in the UK. He's also co-founder and chief scientific officer at Pure Li-Fi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Good afternoon.
This is an old idea, going back, well, way back to Alexander Graham Bell communicating with visible light, right?
That's correct. Alexander Graham Bell was the one who invented the photophone, and in fact, he thought this is his biggest invention, even bigger than the telephone.
Now, you've been working on a system called Li-Fi. There are LEDs and remote controls. Tell us how a Li-Fi system works and how different it is from what we have now.
Right. So you basically said it in your introduction. LEDs are semiconductor devices, a little bit like transistors, and they have the property that we can change the light that comes out of an LED very, very quickly. So that changes in the brightness is what we exploit in order to encode data extremely fast, so that the receiver will be a decoder, a photodetector, which will then see these changes in the light intensity in a way a human eye would not be able to detect. For a human eye, it would be simply constant light. But for a photodetector, it is a change in the intensity, and then we have algorithms that recover these changes in intensity and get back the data stream. And we've shown with LEDs that we can, in the lab, we have shown data rates of up to 15 gigabit per second, and that is, at the moment, more than twice as fast as the fastest Wi-Fi.
Well, so besides just the speed, what advantage does an LED flashing up and down like that and sending out zeros and ones have over a Wi-Fi or even over a laser light?
Right. There are numerous advantages. One of the biggest advantages is that we use spectrum. We use the visible light spectrum, which is by nature about 10,000 times larger than the radio spectrum we use currently in our cellular communication systems. So we can use a vast amount of free spectrum, which is unlicensed and basically installed everywhere. You mentioned it in cars, in our LED lights at home, in street lights, and so on. So it's ubiquitous. It's already there. We can use existing infrastructure in creating a very efficient sort of cellular communications. Huh. That's one advantage. The other advantage is that we have this capacity, this additional capacity, these additional fat data pipes that essentially come for free, and that alleviates what we call the radio frequency spectrum crunch. If you go to an airport into crowded areas and try to log into the Wi-Fi, you probably will find out that the data rates are terribly slow, and that's because of the limited availability of radio spectrum. So it is providing higher capacity. We use existing infrastructure and therefore don't have to have these large infrastructure investments. And also, it is more secure. If you go out and try to sort of log into Wi-Fi networks, probably you will see 20 to 30 Wi-Fi networks, and that basically would mean you could break into them. So eavesdrop into ongoing communications is a standard problem at the moment. So, but light wouldn't go through walls, and therefore it would be more secure than Wi-Fi. And the fourth big advantage is that we can use Li-Fi in areas where we traditionally can't use radio, such as underwater, or in intrinsically safe environments like petrochemical plants or oil rigs, everywhere where an antenna could spark an explosion.
Interesting. We're talking about the new world of Li-Fi with Harold Hoss on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, could you, we're talking about a lot of times about the cars and self-driving cars and the need for cars to communicate with each other if they're going to be, be safer. Could your headlight flash an LED at the other car and so they sort of talk to each other as they're approaching and know where they are and exchange communication?
Yes, this is indeed one of the further applications that the car headlights, if you go to a BMW, for example, they use headlights where the white light beam is generated out of three LEDs, a red, a green, and a blue LED. And these are laser LEDs and cover up to 600 meters. And we can use these LEDs to transmit sort of data from car to car and use the backlight to relay back the information. And this is a way we can enhance safety on our roads and even extend the vision. So sort of normally you see the car in front of you, but if you were able to relay high definition video from, say, three cars in front of you, you could see earlier what's happening on the street and therefore enhance security. That's actually one of the many applications that we see with this sort of emerging technology.
Wow. But if it is emerging, how soon are we going to see it in practical use?
We see it already. I think we in the company PureLifi, we are already at the third generation of products. So we have it installed in various pilot projects in the security industry, but also in wireless communications and lighting, where the industry at the moment faces a big problem with the LED light, because the LED light lasts about 20 years, and so the industry can't sell light bulbs every 6 months to customers. There need to be a new business model which means that an LED or a light bulb need to have additional features, additional functions other than just lighting. And that is where LiFi plays a key role, because with LiFi we create a channel that could host sort of thousands of applications, from home sensing of elderly. You'll find out if people sort of have fallen down. You could find out in the way you would navigate indoors, so it's for indoor navigation, and many, many more applications would be possible with light. And we, as a company, run several projects in these industries.
Mm-hmm. We'd have to integrate them right into an adapter in our USB port or something like that?
Right, absolutely. So at the moment, it's a device that you stick into the USB port of your laptop. So we are now on a very, very radical path towards miniaturization. We will see soon dongles coming out, and then eventually, if everyone sees the big advantage of that technology, we are very confident that it will be integrated into smartphones.
Harold Haas, Professor of Engineering, University of Edinburgh, in the UK, co-founder and Chief Scientific Officer of PureLifi. Thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. One last thing. You might have already suspected this from your own research, but working long hours could be bad for you. A new study out in Lancet this week showed that people who worked 55 hours or more per week had 33% increased risk of stroke, 13% increased risk of heart disease, even up to 48 hours is a risky time, too. The study didn't say why, but you probably can guess it has something to do with stress and all the inactivity and bad food you eat on overtime. So ask your boss for fewer hours this week, unless, of course, you are the boss, and now we know why you're working so hard. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Roskin, our video producer. Production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls of the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You've heard of origami, the art of paper folding, but you've heard of DNA origami. Researchers have folded up a bunny out of DNA. It's our picture of the week, sciencefriday.com/DNA.